WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with local writer and VPR commentator Bill Mayers. He is president of the Vermont Beekeepers Association, a former high school teacher, and was member of the Vermont House of Representatives from 1985 to 1991. An avid runner, reader, choral singer, and traveler, he also has a great passion for history, philosophy, and fishing. Bill Mayers is the author of more than a dozen books, including 314 and Out, which we're going to discuss in this interview, Bees Besieged, Fishing with the Presidents, and Brewing Change, which is the other book we discussed. A graduate of Harvard College and the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, he has contributed to the Christian Science Monitor, The Economist, and the Chicago Sun-Times, among other publications. He lives in Burlington, Vermont, with his wife, Chris Hadsell. When I spoke with Bill Mayers, I began by asking him about his work as a VPR commentator and what he likes about writing the personal essay.
Well, I think it's a discipline. I mean, once you get over the hump of saying, "Well, do I really have something to say?" and say, "Well, I'll try that and try not to look like a fool," then. The challenge is, how can you say something coherent in 500 words and have a beginning and a middle and end, all the requirements of good writing? And it's fortunate that Betty Smith, who created this genre maybe 25 or 30 years ago and continues to do it at VPR, is a wonderful editor, and she has a very good sense of how to help you find your own way through your own prose. And sometimes it's more thorn-ridden than rose-covered. But I think that over the 5 years that I've done this, I think she's only persuaded me not to do one. Even there were some that went through 6 or 8 drafts back and forth, and others are go more smoothly. But in all cases, she's been a pole star of warm editing support.
Okay, great. Now, one subject. There's one subject she had you not do. Is that right?
Or yeah, I can't. It was something to do with public policy. I don't know whether it was Iraq or political corruption or something where I just. It was just more of a personal screed, and she just said, "Well, look, you know, it's too." She. One of the things she keeps saying is, "Don't be rhetorical. Don't ask questions to the reader, to the listener. Just give them your spiel. I mean, they're listening at." She says, "They're listening at 50 miles an hour. They don't really want a dialogue. They want to hear you out, and so you want to make that as easy as possible."
And they want to talk about it with other people later.
They can talk about it with other people, yeah. And I think that also, in the broader sense, they don't have a mechanism for... So these are not really blogs in the sense that they invite public comment.
Sure.
I think she doesn't want to manage it. And frankly, I don't really want to do it either. I want to get done with one and go on to another. I'm not...
Right.
Interested in having a continuing seminar about them, yeah.
Yeah. So does she come up here when you're going to do it?
No. The process is almost all by email, because I'll send her the draft. I hope it's as final as possible. And then she sends back, and she has this wonderful word, tweaks. So it's some tweaks here, some tweaks there. And I approve them or not, or change. And largely I approve them, and we could go back and get this thing ever more refined. But as you know, whenever you speak something aloud, you see stuff that you didn't see when it was written. So there's usually a couple of very minor things that will happen either when I'm reading it for myself just before I go on the air, or even when I'm reading it with one of the engineers over there. And so we make a a change, and they, I don't know if they actually type it up as it's spoken or not, but sometime it has to get into that final form. So every once in a while there's a one or two words that aren't the same between what I spoke and what gets printed on their website. But it's pretty close.
Okay.
I mean, and so, yeah, so then I go and do the recording, and then it, I'm not sure whether she sees it between the time I recorded and the time it actually gets put on the air. I don't know if she does that, but she's usually satisfied that when I'm doing it with the engineer,
right,
that it's going to be close.
Right. Now, have you gotten in the habit from doing this, perhaps, or even were you already in the habit before, of reading your work aloud anyway? So when you're working on an article or a book chapter?
You know, that's one of these things where... You know, do what I say, not what I do. I certainly, and when I would tell my students, anytime I'm telling anybody writing, I always say read it aloud. But I didn't do it as rigorously as I do it this time,
uh-huh.
because I know it's to be spoken as opposed to so much of the writing is to be read. So, but it's an invaluable tool, and I wish I did it more, and I wish more people did it more. But it. I'm just not as good a follower of my own advice as I would like to be.
Yeah, well, it's kind of embarrassing. You know, I mean, I'll do it because I write. And so somebody walks in the room and you're immediately like, I don't want to be seen doing this. It's awkward.
Well, no, I would do it upstairs and by myself. But it still is, it's not in that absolutely necessary realm. I mean, if you could have a vocal voice check, where you could run it through a machine and it would pick it up that way, but you can't do it. You have to do it, and you have to take that time to actually read it. But it's an amazing how different the experience is, because it's become physical and not just mental, not just reading across the page, but actually forming these words. And it's, to me, it's kind of like the difference between writing stuff in longhand and just punching out on a computer.
Yeah, it is different, isn't it?
Yeah.
The subject of some of your essays is beekeeping, and you've also written a book about bees. So I wonder how and when you started beekeeping.
Chris and I, my wife and I lived in St. Johnsbury 40 plus years ago, and there was a man there who's a retired geologist, and we got to know him partly because his wife and my mother had been in college together, but more because he'd been a serious beekeeper as a kid, and then he hadn't done it when he was in his professional life. Then as soon as he got to St. Johnsbury, he immediately had 20 or 25 hives, and he loved to teach people beekeeping. So he became the Pied Piper of beekeeping. And I just thought, well, this is really a pretty cool thing to start. And he was happy to give me my first year and a half of lessons. And he was so generous with his time that I swore that if I ever became his age, I would do the same thing. And so I kept up the hobby all these years and then have been teaching it for the last 10 years and writing a book about it. And
what was his name?
Arnold Waters.
All right, so and then you've written a book on beekeeping. Are you writing more books or more works about bees?
No, I'm not doing any more books on bees. I'm doing a book about running and singing, which will be out in April, and then I'm working on another book with a UVM professor about World War I and Civil War, war memorials. My agent once said, don't ever write a book with someone else. You know, it's worse than a marriage. But it hasn't been that way. It's varied. Some have been testier than others. But I think it can be wonderful. But I think that you really need to set the parameters at the beginning of who's going to do what. And if you find it changing, you stop and have a mid-course correction. Because I once did a book in which the I came to quite different conclusions than the other guy, and it was not just intellectually, it wasn't fun. And then it became, you know, personally, it wasn't fun. But
did you end up putting the book out?
We did.
Yeah,
we did. But I think. I mean, there's some that fall into very clear. So if you were the photographer and I was a writer, that'd be pretty clear.
Yeah.
But where you're, the closer you are to shared experiences, the more important it is to have a clear division of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So in the book with Rick, Brewing Change, was there any question as to who was doing what, or was it pretty clear?
No, because it wasn't. It was always, for 5 years, it was always this, I'm going to ask you questions, I'm going to type this thing up, you're going to look at it, send it back to me, and then we'll go back and forth like that. So it was always, I was the questioner, I was the reader, increasing informed reader, and he was the writer.
Yeah.
He was the source of all the material. And that's one reason why I didn't want to get into these separate interviews with other people and try to triangulate what other people were saying about him or about the same experience. It was too much work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is a lot cleaner.
Yeah. And the book that you're working on now, you were talking about working on a World War One and Civil War.
Yeah, this one is, yeah. Is that a
collaboration?
Yes, with a retired UVM art history professor, uh-huh. Bill Lipke.
Have you worked together before?
Nope, but we've sung together for 30 years.
Okay.
And this is we've both been interested in the First World War for a long time, and he's actually done a lot of work on the Canadian experience. So he's always wanted to publish this stuff in some way. And I said, "Well, now's the time."
Okay, mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
And the book, Running and Singing, as two occupations. That
well, there was a coincidence where 10 years ago I was singing. I sing with Oriana Singers, and we were singing Bach's St. Matthew Passion on Easter. And then the next day, I was signed up to run the Boston Marathon. So I did these two major things in 27 hours, and it was sort of a meditation on a lifetime of singing and a lifetime of running. And Chris came up with the title. It's called The Bach Road to Boston. So that'll come out in April. And
I like that.
Yeah.
So did you find yourself doing the two together? Were you running and singing literally?
Well, I was. Yes and no. I mean, the book it starts as, you know, what's this oxymoronic collect, you know, two things that don't seem to have anything to do with them, and my experience was, you know, they did sort of come together in rhythm and in and there's some about my own religious beliefs and the juxtaposition of, you know, something that's so self-centered and then something that is so selfless. So I thought that was we all live through, I think, I mean, if you've got any moral sense, is trying to just to deal with, you know, your own interests and the interests of others. I mean, you're not here just to live out your own selfish life, I don't believe. Mm-hmm. And so here is the St. Matthew Passion, which is about the central event of Christianity. So you're singing it one afternoon, and then you go down and with 30,000 other people who are interested only in expressing themselves through their running down the streets of Boston and suburbs. So I thought that was
interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
May I read a quick paragraph from the book?
Sure.
This is from one of the early essays from 314 and out. And the essay is called Bees and the Tunbridge World's Fair. And it's going to be a little out of context, but I'll read the last two paragraphs. Most Vermont beekeepers are hobbyists with just a few hives that we don't move around. This gives bees time to recover their strength over the winter. Of the handful of professionals like Mike, only one moves bees out of state each year. So what do we do? Asked our customer as we closed up shop at 10 p.m. We walked out into the chill air amid the lingering smells of cigarette smoke, onions, cotton candy, and fried dough. Well, I said, just keep buying lots of local honey. which was your advice to him about what we do to help the dilemma of the bees. But I loved those paragraphs because it's so full of the feel of the fair and the smells in particular. It made me think about how important it is to include all the senses when we write anything that you're trying to evoke a moment in time. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think, again, one of those rules that you always get in every book, at least you should, is be as concrete as possible and, you know, use the active voice and keep things short and punchy. And because particularly when you're reading something just to a disparate an audience out there, you can't see. I mean, all you've got is the tone of your voice and these images. And I just think that you know, if you can avoid adjectives and adverbs and just make the stuff nouns and verbs, you know, with a little bit of help from these helping words, I think it's much stronger. I mean, I sometimes get carried away with adverbs and adjectives, but I think that it just makes, particularly in this form, it makes it easier for the reader to grasp what you're talking about. And so, again, it's one of those rules I consciously try to obey, but I don't always succeed. But, you know, it's kind of like Orwell when he talks about how there's always been was always a political purpose in his writing. And he said he could always tell when his writing was getting flaccid, was when it didn't have this political purpose. And so I would sort of paraphrase that and say, when I didn't have concrete words or images, that the writing was flaccid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You must be a fan of Flannery O'Connor.
Well, somewhat. I am a great fan of Orwell's. I mean,
she has a huge essay about writing with concrete detail, which is what made me think.
Good. another person who's I laud anonymously.
All right, great. I was interested that the essays, as you put them in the book, they don't have dates attached to them. And I wondered if you thought about including the dates of the broadcast or the dates that they were written, or did you just want them to sort of be more kind of universal?
Well, I think that was a decision by Windrich, and I, okay. I don't know that there was any great torment. I just in terms of layout, since it was 4 years, I think that we also tried to take out the ones that were really topical, so that when you read them 2 or 3 years later, you weren't reading about something that was evanescent and gone.
And getting all worked up about old what's his name,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, and I think we simply said, well, I don't know, it doesn't add anything. If you put a parenthesis and say this is 2009 or this is 2011, it's not going to add to the reader's understanding. I mean, if it were over a 20-year span, yes.
Yeah.
But we just I also let them choose the categories. I just figured I couldn't. It's too hard for me to do, and I think they did a perfectly acceptable job.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I had a question about the structure of the book. It's structured in 6 sections, so they came up with those?
Yeah.
And did you have any opinions about it or suggestions about it? Just decided that they had done a good job.
I just figured they brought a clean eye to this melange of stories, and if they had a structure that made sense to them, that was fine with me.
Right, and because
I hadn't done them in that way.
Right. I was going to ask if you would read from the book. And
sure.
This is Bill Mayers reading from 314 and Out, a collection of Vermont Public Radio commentaries published by Windridge Publishing in Shelburne, Vermont.
A life-changing bet. The first time I heard this story was during the Thanksgiving holidays, when here's what happens. You know, you're out there and you make a mistake, and the nice thing is you stop, and then you really just have to do the same sentence over again. You don't have to start and do the whole thing over again.
Can I keep that? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
The first time I heard this story was during the Thanksgiving holidays, while deer hunting with my father and two brothers in West Texas. My father's father, Josef Marisch, was born Žamberk, Bohemia, in what is now the Czech Republic. We share a birthday, November 8, me in 1940, he in 1856. After 4 years in Berlin, training to be a shoemaker, he returned to Žamberk to find a draft notice from the Austro-Hungarian army. Unwilling to serve the emperor, he fled to the United States. He arrived in eastern Montana in 1877, a year after Custer's last stand, and found work as a cowboy rounding up horses to sell to the British Army for its wars in southern Africa. After 2 years on the plains, he got a chance to use his leatherworking skills making shoes and mule harnesses in the mining town of Marysville, about 20 miles from the territorial capital of Helena. He worked very hard for 10 years and put half his savings into a bank in Helena and half into grubstaking miners. Now, grubstaking was that peculiar combination of a lottery and welfare system of lending money to miners in return for a share of their discoveries, which for most miners were exceedingly rare. One night, however, there came a rap on his window, and one of the miners he'd invested in told him breathlessly, "They struck the mother lode at the Drumlummon mine. Get out of bed and get into Helena and buy some of their stock before the word gets out." My grandfather saddled up and rode into Helena. At 9 a.m., he surprised a clerk at the bank by pulling out all his savings, about $500. At 9:30, he was at the mine office to buy what stock he could. At noon, news of the strike reached Helena, and the stock doubled in price that day and tripled again by the end of the year. When he sold his stock the next year, he was able to go back to Žamberk, marry, and bring his wife to Montana, where he and his brother founded a meat company and small amusement park on Helena's outskirts. These ventures prospered enough for him to send the three children to college, in my father's case, to Massachusetts Institute of Technology. My father never gambled, except at gin rummy with his sons, and always spoke in grateful awe of the life-changing bet his father had made.
Great. Thanks very much. How often do you have to prepare a commentary for VPRs?
Well, that's the nice thing is... There are 50 people or so in the stable there, and they run the gamut from Barry Dunsmore, who writes like clockwork every 2 weeks. Willem Lang used to do them quite frequently, even weekly. Peter Gilbert does them pretty frequently. And then there are people at the other end of the spectrum who might do two or three a year. And Betty Smith has to keep all of these balls in the air, and fill, let's see, I think it's nine slots, because one slot on Friday always goes to the guy who's the gardening guy, Charlie Nardozzi. So you can do the math. You got 50 people, and you got nine slots per week. Divide that up. But in 5 years I've done 100. So it's been about, one every two and a half weeks. But it's not, she doesn't call up and say, "I need one." So sometimes I've had them 3 weeks in a row, and then I've gone 4 or 5 weeks sometime without having one. And they never fit in a particular slot. I just do them and let them decide. I don't sit around waiting. I almost never listen to them.
That's what you said. What happens if it comes on the radio and you're out and about in the world? Do you turn it off?
Well, no, I don't turn it off, but I usually don't get the whole thing either. In real life, I hear all the mistakes. And I hear all the, and it sounds kind of fatuous, and I just think, no. It's like reading my own prose. I never read my own prose. You know, I guess the good side is once I'm done with it, it's recorded, it's in the bank, I go on to think about the next one. And
do you have trouble coming up with the next one sometimes, or are you usually
No, I have. I'm pretty good. I keep three or four at least in play. I have on my computer in the VPR file, I have a folder that has all of them done, and then there's a list of three or four or five ones that I can look at and say, okay, where does this one stand? And I'm also trying to think what's topical. Like this one I just did about giving, I just thought, well, this is the season. And I thought, well, what have I got to say about giving? So I cranked something out pretty quickly and sent it to her. And she said, oh, well, we'll do it tomorrow, because she had a slot. I mean, that was just, I don't know, it was just 2 days ago. And others will first sit in my head, then we'll do them with Betty, and then they'll sit, you know, in her queue. So it's, I would say that it's been comfortable, and I've only been once or twice. I've gone about a week, and I said, what am I going to write about next? And then something comes up, and I'm able to do it.
Yeah, well, perhaps the regularity of having done it for so long just kind of means that there are things percolating even when you're not aware of them.
It'd be really hard to to be one of these columnists. And when I worked for the Chicago Sun-Times, the companion newspaper was the Chicago Daily News, and Mike Royko wrote every day.
Mike Royko was amazing.
Yeah, 5 days a week he's punching out stuff with one assistant. I mean,
it wasn't always profound.
No, of course not. I mean, no one can be profound every day.
I remember he had one about jar envy, which is what women feel when their husbands open the jar for them.
Oh, that's great.
That was funny. Well, you've written a book on brewing beer many years ago, and then recently you wrote another one about brewing coffee. And that one is called Brewing Change, Behind the Bean at Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. And its co-author is Rick Pizer, about whom much of the book is written. So I wonder if you have any, if you've noticed similarities when you were writing the book on brewing beer and brewing coffee. Did you notice many similarities about?
No, they were entirely different books. I mean, it just happens that the people think of brewing beer and they think of brewing. No, this was, first of all, a jointly authored book, and indeed, it's. I said in my introduction, I said, look, the idea was mine, the book is Rick's, and I've written books with three other people, and each one is different. The books are different, but the four books with Frank Bryan about Vermont, they were of a piece. I mean, we were working together on the subject of Vermont, but in this case, I went to Rick and said, I mean, I've known him for 20 years, and I said, You've had a huge influence on both the company and the industry, and you should tell your story. And it really grew out of another book that I had done, or the idea was a professor from the University of Massachusetts, and I wrote a book about workplace democracy. Mm-hmm. And there was a chapter in there about middle managers and how in a democratized organization, the table of organization gets compressed and the middle managers get squeezed. And so there's a lot less for them to do. And I looked at Rick and I said, here you are, a middle manager who's having a phenomenal influence on your company and outside the company. So this is kind of the anti-Donald Trump, anti-Jack Welch book where, and the message, you don't have to be the CEO to have this great influence, and you should tell the story. Mm-hmm. So I kept feeding him questions, and over 4 or 5 years, we put this into a chronological shape, and so that's really what it is. So there might be, you know, everything in the book is really out of Rick's mouth. I put it on paper, but it wasn't as if he was giving me the outline and I was writing it. It was really a lot. Most of it was his prose.
Because you interviewed him and
I interviewed him, put the stuff down on the tape recorder, and then went back to him. And sometimes I would go off for a paragraph on what I thought he was saying, and we would. So it was a very much a joint book. But the ideas, the experience, was all his. I wasn't bringing any experience to it, as I've done in other co-authored books.
Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned the thing about his being a middle manager and having great influence. And as I was reading the book, it struck me that either he's, and maybe it's both, he's incredibly humble, it sounds like. You know, he doesn't toot his own horn a lot. But also, it seems like he had some pretty good luck in certain moments. You know, I mean, there were moments where his direction in the company looked like it was in a little bit of a difficult spot, and then a new position opened up that he could move into that would better that would be better served by his qualifications.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all that way. I think it, he didn't want to just be the best direct marketing person around. I mean, he got this opportunity to be the PR director, and as he said, he told Stiller or the other guys, he was perfectly content to do that. But then this was a way of starting to manage that new money that was flowing into the, you know, the company, and he ran with it because he was already pushing the limits of what he could do in PR by going and learning Spanish and traveling. And he'd like to say, I kept pushing and no one pushed back, but he was also benefiting from the culture that Stiller established. Sure. Now, if he'd tried to do this at FedEx or Walmart, I mean, no, he wouldn't have gotten as far. So,
yeah.
In a way, it is kind of a dual biography of him. I mean, it's a good reflection on Green Mountain, but I didn't want to push him. And I didn't want to go out and do a lot of interviews at Green Mountain, so we could really say, okay, here's the Green Mountain, and here's Rick, and here's how they fit together. I just wanted Rick to tell his story because he was so intrinsically humble that every once in a while it'd be a little harder to tease out from him the stuff where he was really becoming a leader. And I think when you talk to the people around him, I mean, he's very much he's very respected and beloved. And I never asked him this directly, but I think that he could have said to himself, I really want to go up the corporate ladder. It was the 30th or 40th employee hired, and by now he could be one of those second level down. I don't think he would have been president, but he could have been making 10 times as much money, but he said, I'm making enough money, my kids have gone to college, and, you know, he is an incredibly modest guy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about what he did with the company, because it's a pretty neat story. So to talk about that, we need to talk about Green Mountain Coffee Roasters' environmental focus and their stewardship program.
Yeah, the stewardship program was this first effort, very modest effort, to link to arouse the buyers of their coffee to the link to the people who are actually picking this coffee, and to brand social development and environmental protection, and it. Probably didn't get pushed, partly because of the at that time the management was not that enthusiastic about it, and they were also running into the sort of label fatigue of, you know, what do you put on the the packaging, and so there was an overlap where they did Rick's, I mean, he didn't do this alone, but the organic coffee movement, the production and the supply of organic coffees began to be available, and he encouraged the company to do that, and then I can't remember whether Stiller banged on the table and said we have to have organic coffee or fair trade coffee, one of them.
And he was organic.
Yeah, is he organic?
Yeah.
So he bangs the table at a meeting and said, we got to get organic coffee. So Rick helped but he wasn't in the coffee department, but he worked with those people to bring organic coffee. So then, you know, Green Mountain could put this on their labels, and they could show this their green credentials, both in the field and in the company. Meanwhile, Stiller has got them to develop this new filter, which is environmentally...
it's not bleached or something, is that correct? Or there was some sort of toxin that was taken out?
Yeah, there's something that the toxin was taking out, and then they converted, at some point they converted their trucks to gas, or so they were doing stuff internally here, and then they started to push the organic coffee, and then then I think Rick probably was instrumental in getting them to pick up fair trade, and so he pushed that supply, and he would go around still in his job of PR, and he'd give talks about it at the colleges, Villanova and Hampshire and some other places, and then so he was doing that, and then he I think someone asked him. Oh, he started to go to the SCAA meetings, probably his second or third year. But meanwhile, he'd gotten really turned on by Bill Fishbein and the Coffee Kids, which mm-hmm. was really working in the field through microcredit and to help the farmers. And he traveled with them. He went on their board. He became president. So here he is. One time he showed me a list of all, he had this timeline of all the different organizations that he was serving on. He has like eight different groups on top of his day job
right. That
were coffee related. And he was able to keep them all in order.
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I was trying to just follow all the acronyms in the book.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, so meanwhile, he's taking his vacations and going and doing the Spanish. And
I was really disturbed, and so was he, obviously, which is why he did so much about it, to read the chapter about los meses flacos, or
right.
the thin months.
Yep.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, he was shocked, and he came back and he said, he told Time Magazine, or told several people, I was ready to quit. He says, here I'm in the coffee industry for 15, 16 years, and these people are hungry. I mean, we're giving them the best, we're buying organic coffee, we're buying fair trade coffee, and still they're going hungry.
Right, and the thin months refers to a period of the year where
when they run out of money, because they get paid once a year.
Okay.
And I suppose the business school types could come in and say, well, you're just not planning doing better, you know, do better home economics management, so stretch your budget out a little more. But he didn't take that view. He said, look, these people are starving. What are we going to do about it? So he, again, pushed the company to do a film about it. He formed this nonprofit, Food for Farmers.
Right.
To pursue this. I've gone on the board. A number of other people around here are on the board. And it's devoted solely to this question of how to get supplemental income, how to get more food to the farmers during this period of the thin months. And so because there were other groups, lots of big groups that had food security as part of their mission,
mm-hmm.
but nothing was dedicated to it directly. And so Rick wanted to be part of that, and so that's why he's formed this, and he's been true to his word, and we're trying to build up enough projects that we can then share those. I mean, not only do some direct work, but it's more, we're still so small that if we can persuade the big guys like Save the Children or Catholic Relief Services to take on some of the things that we find out, then that we're happy to do that.
Yeah. Now I want to mention Windridge Publishing always gives 10% of net profit of the sale of a book to an organization of the author's choice, and in your case, it's this Food for Farmers. But also, you and Rick have decided that 100% of your earnings from the book will support Food for Farmers, which is
yep.
foodforfarmers.org, and that's a number four, food number four, farmers.org, which is pretty neat. Did Green Mountain Coffee Roasters have any rights to review a draft before the book went to publication, other than Rick?
No. They didn't have any rights. We let them read it.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah, we asked. Several people read it, a couple of people in the PR department, and then I think we offered it to or we sent it to the lawyers, and they said, fine, they took it, and then whatever happened, they ran out of time, said, fine, okay, just send it back. But we've heard nothing from them that...
Nor would you. I was just curious as far as going...
No, Rick felt that it was important to give them whatever opportunity we could, but I thought there wasn't anything. How could they be offended by anything that was in the book?
Right. So. No, it's a wonderful. It's wonderful for them. I can see up here on your shelf that you're a fan of Nabokov.
My wife.
Oh, your wife.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and you mentioned Orwell. So, who are a few of your other favorite authors?
Well, I made a list.
Okay.
Shakespeare, Melville, Evelyn Waugh. I also, when I have only 5 minutes before I'm going to fall asleep, I have two favorite little books. One is Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary, and then I love to read, there's a great book called Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. And Brewer was an Englishman in probably the early part of the 20th century, and it's been constantly revised, but it gives you all these wonderful, real but non-dictionary explanations for the source of words like fata morgana or mutatis mutandi. So it's words of in most languages, English, French, Latin. Forget it's got 8 pages about the origins of British military regiments. Mm. Each of them has a name, and he explains that. So. Just reading that randomly is a wonderful way of just relaxing.
Yeah. Do you know? Are you really familiar with it all now, or have you not begun to cover the whole thing?
Familiar with what?
All the book. Like, have you read the whole thing by now, or?
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Maybe even twice.
I don't know.
I mean.
So you're just reading.
Well, I just like, yeah, I read at it. I didn't sit down and read it straight through. But I've always loved to read reference books. I used to read dictionaries when I was a kid.
So do you find new entries that you haven't seen before?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, the older you get, the more you forget. So, you don't even know if you've read them before.
Okay. Are you reading anything contemporary right now?
I'm just finishing the Hilary Mantel, not the latest one, the Wolf Hall, which is great. So I'm going to go out and buy the Bring Up the Bodies next. Chris and I went to the Czech Republic in October, and I read War and Peace again. I'm reading a lot of First World War books, both fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah.
Now,
I wanted to just get back to the Hilary Mantel for a minute. I know that you, in a previous career, were a history teacher for many years. Is English history part of your expertise? Did you teach that at all?
Well, I taught European history.
Okay.
And American history and American foreign policy.
So when you read Wolf Hall, I'm reading Wolf Hall.
Yeah.
And I'm really enjoying it.
Yep.
But I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
You know, I keep having to kind of like... run and read a little bit more about Thomas More and what did these people all do. She's not really explaining everything, although she is writing a beautiful universe for me to explore. But I kind of have to do some of the exploration myself. So did you find that too, or were you already...
Well, I knew all that stuff. I mean, I knew enough so that I could enjoy her fictionalization and her detail of this character. I got about halfway through, and I said, I don't really care whether Cromwell is, whether this is true to his character. This is just a great piece of literature, and this is a character who's out of High Noon or Humphrey Bogart. You know, I wouldn't, you know, Humphrey Bogart could play this character.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's just such a... You know, he's playing this four-dimensional chess game of moving things around, and so as a tour de force that is set in a plausible, in a known historical situation, that was really good, and I'm not I can be critical of people that take excessive liberties with historical fiction, because I think it's easy to cheat at both ends. I mean, you can cheat and make the history fit your story, or you can cheat and make the story fit the history. But
yeah,
this one seemed to be an honest and dare I say brilliant description of what the period was like. I mean, here's a guy but deals with three deaths in his family in two pages, and it's, you know, and she writes about it in such a normal way that, you know, this must have been the way they lived. I mean,
right,
it's, you know,
right,
we would go on for chapters on dealing with the death of two daughters, but there it is.
Yeah. And part of it is, and it is shocking because you see how people are interacting with him, and it's partly the time, and everybody's just so used to death.
Yeah.
But
it is
interesting. Yeah.
So it helps. To read science fiction or to read medical fiction would be harder for me because I don't have enough of the biology and medicine to feel comfortable in that environment. Although I did read one of the books, Robert Harris, the one he wrote about. There's one about a guy breaking into computers. I found it interesting, but I think it's his style. He gives you enough human tissue to follow it,
right,
and enjoy it.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for competent writers who are not yet professional writers, but they want to write and publish nonfiction? How would you suggest they get their start?
Well, I suppose it's never been easier to publish yourself.
Yeah.
And the whole word vanity press has been expanded into, I mean, you could argue anybody's got a blog is publishing. I think if it's probably also never been, or certainly harder to get published in traditional mainstream book, you know, press like Knopf or Macmillan or so forth. But in between those two, there's a lot. And
have you published your own work in
no. No, I've never wanted to do that. I had enough. I never wanted to do it, never had to do it. But the progression of, if you look at sort of a downward, the presses that have published my books have been smaller and smaller every year. I mean, it isn't like I had Knopf for three times and then Doubleday and but I think it's really tough. But I don't know. I think maybe the first advice would be, what do you want to get out of this? If you just, do you want yourself, and what's the form? Do you want to look at yourself in a book that's justified with hardcover an ISBN number? Do you want something for my college roommate? Spent 2 years after he retired, in maybe 2.5 years, in editing his parents' letters. His father was killed in the Second World War, and so there were 5 years of letters between him and his father and his mother. And he edited these in a book that's 600 pages. But
wow.
He made 10 copies. He made ones for the family and one for himself, and I think he sent one to the Naval Academy. But that way, he had a very finite. I kept saying, "Well, you ought to write your own memoirs," but he didn't want to do that. But he did. He said, "This is what I wanted to do," and he did it, and he got it done. So I think it depends upon, you know, kind of keeping reins on your ego, or at least saying what's the end product. You know, what do I want out of this? Do I want praise from my neighbors? Do I want praise from anonymous reviewers? Do I want the feel of a book?
How about to earn a living? What's your?
Oh my God!
It's not possible.
Very well. No, it's possible for some people. But I think you end up cobbling together a lot of the most people. And I read, I don't know if it's right, but 10 or 15 years ago, there was a statistic that said that even the people who call themselves writers only averaged about $5,000 or $10,000 a year from the writing. So they were either teaching school or had some other kind of day job. You know, there are very few Chris Bojalians and Howard Mosiers and it's tough. I mean, even if we look at journalists. So if one of our boys said, "I'm going to be a writer, Dad," I say, "Well, just keep your day job."
Okay. All right. Well, listen, that is it. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Great.
It was a pleasure.
Well, terrific. Yeah, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Bill Mayers. You can find archives of his commentaries at Vermont Public Radio website, vpr.net. And you can learn more about his publisher, Wind Ridge Publishing, at windridgepublishing.com. I'm going to just mention Bill's wife, Chris Hadsel, whom he mentioned a few times during our interview, is the founder and director of Curtains Without Borders, a conservation project dedicated to documenting and preserving historic painted scenery. And I just think the work is really cool. So I'm going to mention the website, which is curtainswithoutborders.org. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Penny Cluse Cafe, a team that creates a multitude of baked goodies, soups, daily specials, and creative cocktails. Penny Cluse offers a range of cuisine and is available to cater special events. Penny Cluse is located in downtown Burlington at the corner of Cherry and South Winooski and at pennycluse.com. And by VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. I was over at VCAM one day. I mentioned this every week about who they are and what their mission is, and it's a pretty cool place, it occurred to me it would be really wonderful to be able to access some of the tools and equipment that they make available to local citizens. So just to mention that, VCAM is a pretty cool place too. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. The Dorothy Alling Memorial Library in Williston presents eBooks for Kindle. That's tonight, Monday, January 28th at 6:30. More information at 802-878-4918. The library will also present their second session on Lincoln in honor of the bicentennial of his birth, Wednesday, January 30th at 6:30. This second session is called The Portable Lincoln by Andrew Dalbanco, Vermont Humanities Reading and Discussion Series. This will be led by John Turner. More information at 802-878-4918. Heart and Soul in Essex and the Phoenix Bookstore in Essex present Susan Clark, co-author of Slow Democracy, Wednesday, January 30th at 6:30. More information at phoenixbooks.biz or 802-872-7111. The Fletcher Free Library presents a book discussion, How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm and Other Adventures in Parenting. That's in the local history room at the library, January 30th at 7. Laurel Bongiorno leads this discussion on global parenting styles. Phoenix Books in Burlington presents B.A. Shapiro, author of The Art Forger, Thursday, January 31st at 6:30. More information at phoenixbooks.biz or 802-448-3350. And then the Fletcher Free Library presents the next Writers as Readers book discussion group. This group examines writers as readers in a set of two book series, and this month they're going to look at one work by Laura Ingalls Wilder and one book about her. On February 6th at 7:30 in the Fletcher Room, the discussion will be about Wilder's book Farmer Boy. And then on February 13th at 7:30, the discussion centers around The Wilder Life, My Adventures in the Lost World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, which is a book by Wendy McClure. So that meeting will be in the local history room at the Fletcher Free, and both sessions are going to be led by Peter Burns. this week's Write the Book prompt is to write a commentary. Choose a subject that interests you, decide what it is you want to say about that subject, and then write 500 words about it. Edit the piece for concision and read it aloud to yourself to see if it would translate well to radio. A well-written paragraph is not the same on paper as it is spoken out loud, as you'll probably notice when I occasionally stumble over myself on here. So it's really helpful to read it aloud ahead of time to see how it would sound. If you like it, submit it to a local station, one of your local community or public radio stations, or you could submit it here to Write the Book. More information about how to submit the outcomes of your prompts to the radio show is on my website, writethebook.podbean.com. I'll talk more about that in a minute. So good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. And if you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org. Every Monday from 2 to 3, archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. We're also on Twitter with the name Write the Book, all one word. And then, as I mentioned a minute ago, in keeping with today's prompt, where I invited you to write and submit a commentary in the spirit of Bill Mayer's work for radio, I'm now accepting submissions of writing prompt outcomes for possible inclusion on the show. And actually, that doesn't just refer to today's prompt about commentaries. It means all the prompts. If you're happy with something that you've written after using a Write the Book prompt, feel free to email it to me. And I have submission guidelines on the website. And if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a guest to recommend that I interview or a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.